Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join us here on the program to be part of our discussion, feel free. Phone numbers here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send your emails during the live broadcast to jx@jeffnet.org. Generations of Americans know President John F. Kennedy only from old films and history books, but older generations remember JFK alive, and suddenly not. November 22nd marks 50 years since the JFK assassination in Dallas, and as the date approaches, you'll hear more about the man and his early death. Two guests join us today to talk about JFK and his passing. Joyce Halica is a JFK admirer and collector and historian and much more, and much of her memorabilia is on display at the Medford Center shopping area through November 22nd. Thank you, Joyce, for joining us here.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
And Robert J. Groden joins us on the phone. He's made books and movies about the shooting and will speak at the Medford Library on Wednesday. Robert Groden, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Robert, let's start with you. You've been quite busy over the years. Why such a strong interest in the Kennedy assassination?
Well, ever since I was a child, I've always been absolutely fascinated by questions of history. President Kennedy was shot on my 18th birthday, and I just gravitated to this. I've been working on the case now for just under 50 years. I was one of the first researchers in the Kennedy case, but did not go public for several years because of fear. It was a frightening thing, nobody wanted to believe that anyone had gotten away with this horrible crime. And the government told us that Lee Harvey Oswald did it and acted alone, and we wanted to believe that no one had gotten away with it. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And back in 1975, I was asked to appear on a national television on a TV show called Good Night America. And on that show, I presented to the public for the very first time ever the films of the actual assassination. And the public outrage was so incredible that I was invited to Washington, D.C. to present the evidence before Congress. And I did. And to my absolute astonishment, 2 days later, the resolution was introduced to reopen the case, and when the case did get reopened, I was named staff photographic consultant to the House Assassinations Committee, and the rest is history. The committee report said that there was a conspiracy. They said that it was too late to investigate the conspiracy, but that it did exist. So we now have a change of history, and I was proud to have been part of that.
The film you mentioned showing on Good Night America, that was with Geraldo Rivera. I remember that program. It wasn't on for long, but there it was. Was that the actual Zapruder film that had been bought by Life magazine and apparently never shown as a film, as a motion picture?
That is correct. You're absolutely right. I worked for a company in New York City, and the original film was brought to us to blow it up from 8 millimeter, the original gauge of the film, to 35 millimeter, which is a professional gauge, to see if it would hold up, and it did. When this went on, let's just say an extra copy was made, fortunately so, because Life magazine was never going to release the film, ever. And when the opportunity presented itself for me to present it on national television, I did. I took the gamble, and I released it, and the public had a right to know. They needed to see this, and that's what changed the history of the Kennedy case.
Let me turn to Joyce Halica here and talk to her about you and JFK. Were you enamored of JFK before the assassination?
Well, if a 17-year-old can be in love, that's not the reason that I collected Kennedy, but I must say that the world admired Kennedy, which was amazing for a president, and I'm so glad I was part of that generation. Actually, my segue into the Kennedys came through Ted Kennedy. When I was in high school, I put on a campaign luncheon for John Tunney, who was then a congressman in Riverside, California, and Ted Kennedy went to school with John Tunney, and John thought it would be advantageous to his campaign to have his friend Edward Kennedy come to Riverside. I met Edward Kennedy because I put on the campaign luncheon. I was class president, and they said, ask Joyce, she'll do it. Mm-hmm. So I received a letter, and I spoke with Ted Kennedy at the luncheon, and he asked me if I was interested in being an intern. And I thought he meant for John Tunney. And I says, what kind of internship? And he said, well, we have internships, summer internships in Washington, D.C., and we look for young people like you that you can give something to, and they can carry it out. So that was my segue into the Kennedys.
And so when did you begin collecting memorabilia on JFK?
On November 22nd, 1963.
Oh, really? So nothing before that time?
No, nothing. Hmm.
And what memories do you have of that day?
Oh, wow. I was a junior in high school, and I was between classes. This is California, so it was about lunchtime, I guess. And it was like everybody else. The world stood still. The speakers that are usually pep assembly speakers, this was a large campus, Rubidoux High School, in case anybody's in Oregon from Rubidoux. Nobody knows Rubidoux much, but it was quite a large school. And I was walking across the so-called grassy knoll of Rubidoux High School when the speakers came on that usually were on for pep assemblies, and we heard the radio announcement over the speakers, and we just stood still and sat and waited, and then it said, you know, to continue on to class, and we did, and we got there, and class was dismissed. It was Spanish 4 class for me, and we went home, and the rest of it is history. We all watched and waited.
As did the world at that time, and
yes,
wondered what had happened. And then the next few days, of course, were quite eventful with the capture of Lee Harvey Oswald, the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald, the burial of John F. Kennedy, all these things in a matter of days across late November 1963. We have much more to talk about with our guests, Joyce Halica and Robert J. Groden, and I can see the phone lines going already as people are interested in talking about the JFK assassination 50 years later. We will talk more with Joyce and Robert and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today, the assassination of John F. Kennedy and memories of JFK when he was alive. It's been almost 50 years to the day, November 22nd, 1963, the shots rang out in Dallas. President Kennedy ended up dead within the half hour. And our guests today are Joyce Halica. She has quite the collection of JFK memorabilia that she began collecting on the date of the assassination nearly 50 years ago, and has a display on at the Medford Center in Medford. Robert Groden will be arriving in Medford later this week to speak about the Kennedy assassination at the Medford Library, and he joins us by phone. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 541-552-6782 by email. Around the region, anywhere, 800-838-3760. Rogue Valley number 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back to you, Robert Groden. I hadn't heard where you were. It was your 18th birthday. You mentioned that already on the November 22nd, 1963. Where were you? You must remember this as well.
Well, as a matter of fact, I do remember exactly. It was my 18th birthday, and I pulled a Ferris Bueller. I took the day off. I played hooky from school that day, and I was sitting at home and heard the first broadcasts over the air. I don't remember which station it was, but the president had not been announced dead yet. They announced that he was shot, but he was still alive. Nobody knew how serious the wounds were. So of course, everybody started to let him pull through, but of course there was really no chance. So I started being interested in it from the moment it happened, even before he was dead, which makes me, I guess, one of the first researchers in the Kennedy case. In any case, my family had been Republicans, and it was President Kennedy who made me realize that it's the man and not the party that counts. And he changed my political view, and when he prevented World War III at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I really admired the man. As a politician, he's probably the first I ever admired, and I just couldn't turn my back on it. I visited his graveside and made a silent promise to him that I would do everything within my power to try to find the truth, no matter where it led. And I've kept my promise to him now for a half a century.
Has this been your career, or do you have a day job in addition to the research?
Well, I did. I was actually a photo optics expert, and that's what I did when I worked for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I've been part of four separate investigations in Washington on the assassination of the president. The most important was the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and I was their staff photographic consultant and worked in the field of photography, but also dealing with medical evidence as well. So that was a bit of a stretch for me, but that's what I did, and I worked in photo optics for, a couple of decades, and I'm essentially retired now as far as that goes. I work full-time on the Kennedy case, and I have a new book coming out in about another month called JFK Absolute Proof with about 1,000 photographs in it. One of the things I've tried to do through the years is to keep the photographic evidence available to researchers and people that want to know the truth. And that's the purpose of the books that I've written.
And so what is the what do you believe happened then?
Well, quite frankly, the simplest way to put it is there was more than one shooter. There was a conspiracy. The president was shot from the front and from the rear. Meaning, of course, that there were at least two shooters, possibly and probably more than that. The actual sound recordings that were done quite by accident by the Dallas Police Department show a series of 15 potential shot impulses, ultrasonic shockwave, muzzle blast, echo patterns, and like that. Some like 42 separate parts of the echo patterns, which fade and get lower and lower as the microseconds go by. If there were 15, that's a lot, certainly a lot. And we don't have proof of 15 except for the sound recording. But there were certainly more than the three that the Warren Commission said. The House Assassinations Committee in 1978 and 79 wrote a report saying that there were at least four shots. And that's where we stand now. The weapon that was supposed to have been used by Lee Harvey Oswald could not fire more than two shots within the time frames twice within the shooting sequence. The first two shots are 1.7 seconds apart. The last two are 0.7 seconds apart. And the minimum firing time for the weapon to get off two shots is 2.3 seconds.
Joyce Halica, what do you believe happened on that day?
Wow. I'll tell you right now, I believe Robert Groden. But, you know, I have a book in front of me called The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, Brothers. And I think I just want to just tell you what Robert Kennedy thought more than what I thought. Robert Kennedy did not resign himself to the lone gunman theory, his official version of his brother's death. But on the contrary, he immediately suspected that President Kennedy was a victim of a powerful conspiracy. So that's what this book is about. So if anybody's interested in knowing more, it's David Talbot, Brothers.
Let's start taking some calls here. We have Mark and Eugene has been quite patient. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joyce Halica and Robert Groden.
Yes, thank you very, very much for putting Robert Groden on the air. It's extremely rare to see any media giving this topic the intelligence that it deserves. I bought a copy of one of Mr. Groden's books when I was in Dallas 4 years ago for the previous anniversary and plan to be there again this year for the 50th. This Friday is the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's speech to the United Nations, calling off the Cold War and also calling off the moon race. He offered to convert the moon race to a cooperative effort with the Soviet Union because if you merge the rocket programs, you can't have a war with rockets. And you can read the full speech at JFKmoon.org. And for listeners in Eugene, I'll be showing the movie JFK to commemorate it this Sunday at 6 o'clock at the eWeb Community Room. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely correct that Robert Kennedy did not believe the Warren Commission. In fact, it was revealed after the fall of the Soviet Union that RFK sent an envoy after the assassination to tell Khrushchev what the truth was, and that the thaw in U.S.-Soviet relations would have to wait until Bobby became president in 1968, which, of course, was not allowed to happen. And last winter, RFK Jr. was in Dallas for an event, and he said publicly, for the first time, that the family never believed the Warren Commission cover-up. And for me, the issue is not whether there was a conspiracy, but why Kennedy was removed from office. He tried to turn off the Cold War and the arms race and the war in Vietnam and many other things. He vowed to scatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and the CIA scattered Kennedy into 1,000 pieces. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the theory there, Mark. Appreciate that. Robert, you want to respond?
Yeah, Mark, I can't improve on what you're saying. You're absolutely right. Bobby Kennedy did not believe the Warren Report. He did not cooperate with Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans because Bobby wanted to run the investigation himself. He knew there was a conspiracy, but he wanted to do it as president. Until he became president, he would not have the power to deal with it. People through the years have said, well, he was attorney general. Why didn't he challenge the Warren Report officially and do something about it as attorney general? What people don't realize is because he got no support from the new president, Lyndon Johnson, he resigned as attorney general before the Warren Report was ever released. So he did not have the power to do anything about it. But anybody who has studied the Kennedy case will have their own theories one way or the other along the line, but if you study the case and if you know the evidence, you've got to believe that there was a conspiracy. I have in my new book, JFK Absolute Proof, which is not quite out yet, but it will be soon, I have the testimony of 88 witnesses who saw the president's body, and every single one of them, without exception, said that the fatal shot came from the front and exited the rear, which is the opposite of the Warren Commission report that said all the shots came from behind.
Are we talking about 88 people with medical expertise here, or just 88 people who happened to see the body in transit, or what?
Three-quarters of them or so were medical people, doctors, nurses, hospital staff like that. Others were just witnesses, say, within Dealey Plaza or Dallas policemen, Secret Service agents. I've interviewed the Secret Service agents that were with the president both in Dallas and in Bethesda Naval Hospital for the autopsy, and they've all said, even them, have said that the shot came from the front. The only three people who said opposite were the three autopsy physicians who were lying through their teeth and just going with the government's official story that all the shots came from behind. They knew it wasn't true, but they didn't want to blow the retirement. They were older men. They were ready to retire, and they were given orders as naval personnel and army personnel to not talk about the truth. And in fact, they didn't.
We are talking to Robert J. Groden, who is a JFK assassination writer and filmmaker, and Joyce Halick, a JFK admirer and collector of JFK memorabilia. They will both be in Medford. Joyce Halick's display of items from the JFK years is on display at the Medford Center now and will stay up through November 22nd. Robert Groden will be at the Medford Library 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock on Wednesday talking about his view of the Kennedy assassination. You can join us here and now on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Rogue Valley local number 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here is Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Groden and Joyce Halicka.
Hiya. Thank you all so much for this program. It's extremely important, I think, for Americans to realize what's going on behind the scenes. Some people are playing hardball. Mr. Groden, thank you so much for your book, High Treason, The Assassination of JFK and the Case for Conspiracy. Great book. Well,
thank you for the kind words.
Yeah, I'd also like to suggest that people, just to maybe pop the balloon of the myth when JFK and all of them were in office, they talked about it being the era. I forget anyway. Seymour Hersh has got a great book called The Dark Side of Camelot. That's what it is. Yeah, Camelot. And so I'd suggest people read that. But Mr. Groden, could you talk a little bit about the so-called three tramps? We've seen seen a lot of photos, and they look very much like some people. Anyway, you might want to talk about that.
All right, well,
sure,
yeah,
sure. Several minutes after the assassination, a freight train, pulled out of the area behind the Dealey Plaza parking lot and started heading south very slowly. A man by the name of Lee Bowers in the railroad tower, who was in charge of releasing those trains, realized this was going on, and he hadn't released it. So he stopped the train, and he called the police. The police came and searched the train, and on the train were three so-called tramps, three guys who were dressed as tramps, hobos, derelicts, and they were arrested and taken down to police headquarters and held for 3 days. These three men were not tramps. They had, in the photographs, and there are seven photographs taken by three different photographers, these guys were wearing new shoes, highly polished, not a single frayed collar or cuff on their pants or their shirts, fresh haircuts, all neatly shaven. These guys were not tramps, and they were held for 3 days until Lee Harvey Oswald was killed and buried, and then they were released. It took nearly 30 years to get the arrest records released at all. The actual paperwork was finally released, the fingerprints and autopsy, I'm sorry, the fingerprints and arrest photographs to this day have never been released.
All right, let's take another call. We have Jeannie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Groden and Joyce Haliga. We're talking about JFK and the JFK assassination.
Hello. John Kennedy came to San Diego in the early 60s, and in junior high school we were let out for the day to go watch, I guess, parade or coming through town. And instead, of course, we went to San Diego Zoo and Balboa Park Museums. That's a big regret. At the same time, my mother, a published writer, had submitted a poem to the San Diego, I believe, Tribune or Union about Kennedy. And I never forget learning the word vehemently to rhyme with Kennedy. But it was a quick poem about an author's work being rejected because he was in town. And at the end, her poem ended by saying, "The work was rejected vehemently because she didn't mention a Kennedy." And also, I did a Ferris Bueller on that fateful day, and I regret that as well. If I would have had the impact of all my classmates and hearing the principal announce. And I remember at home my mother talking to a neighbor, and my mother, a staunch Republican, hated Catholics, hated Democrats, and I saw her crying, and she was mad. She told the neighbor, "What's the punchline?" And the neighbor said, "There is no punchline. Kennedy is dead. He's been assassinated." So there's my story.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeannie. Appreciate
that. You're
welcome. Joyce Haliga, your own memories are quite vivid of that day, and then compare certainly to Jeannie's. Over the years in collecting the memorabilia, did you ever think there was going to be a collection the size of which you have now amassed?
Never in my wildest dreams, Jeffrey. As a matter of fact, I didn't look back as I collected. I put these things away like a time capsule. And at some point, maybe even 10 years ago, I thought to myself, oh my goodness, I'm running out of space. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to have an exhibit, but it's going to have to tie in with some anniversary that people will recognize. So the year 2013 is recognizable as the 50th anniversary of Kennedy, and it seemed like the right time, the right place. It was fortuitous that I did go to Dallas, Texas over President's Weekend. I needed a bust for the exhibit, and I was able to obtain one at the Dallas Depository, and that's where I met Robert Groden. And saw his book, I believe it was called The Killing of a President, sitting on a table, and it was his own personal copy, and I couldn't go without it. So I got that book and got the head of Kennedy, and I just told him at the depository, "There's no way I can carry Kennedy's bust on the plane. I'll never get home."
Right.
So they shipped it to me and arrived on my doorstep.
You mentioned that you started collecting right on November 22nd. Mm-hmm. Were those the newspapers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I think I still have some of those in my possession as well from my parents. Mm-hmm. Back in the days when newspapers put out extra editions mm-hmm. for things like huge news stories like this one. And what other pieces did you pick up over those early years?
One of the earliest pieces I picked up, I didn't actually pick up, it got delivered. I have the Kennedy rocker, which is very iconic. And it arrived in my driveway in Butte Falls on a moving truck from Massachusetts, and a driver came up my driveway, and I thought, oh, he's going to get stuck. And he stopped where he could turn around, and he said, I have a delivery for you. And I had no idea what it was, but I was curious, and I thought, wow. So I walked to the truck, and he opened up the back of the truck, and in the far end of the truck, it was empty, except there was the Kennedy rocker with a strap on it. And he had made all his deliveries from Massachusetts to Oregon. I was his last stop, and he was going back.
Is it a replica?
It is a replica, but when I say replica, they made the Kennedy rocker originally for Kennedy because of his back when he was a senator, and they kept making them, and even people that sit in the Kennedy rocker at the exhibit, they go, oh my goodness, my back feels so much better. So they keep making Kennedy rockers at the Boston, for the Boston Museum, but they're not made there by them.
All right, much more to talk about JFK and the assassination anniversary coming up on November 22nd. Joyce Halica and Robert Groden with us on The Exchange. You can join as well. We'll come back and talk to them and take your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Today we're talking about the John F. Kennedy presidency and assassination. JFK's assassination anniversary is coming up on November 22nd. It will be the 50th anniversary of that, so some strong emotion surfacing once again. Joyce Halica from Butte Falls has put her collection of memorabilia on display in a storefront, I guess, in the Medford Center, as something of a mini JFK museum that'll stay up through November 22nd. She is bringing Robert Groden to town. He is one of the major assassination writers, not believing the official story and believing that there was more than one gun involved. He'll be speaking at the Medford Library at 4 and 7 on Wednesday. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about all this. 800-838-3760. Anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call. Here's Paranoid Paul in Grants Pass is the name we're going by. Paul, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. it is my name. So,
not the paranoid part.
Not the paranoid part. I remember hearing a radio program where I believe John Dean made a deathbed confession. Do you know anything about that?
About what?
Actually, well, it was not John Dean. It was E. Howard Hunt.
E. Howard Hunt, that's right.
One of the other people in the Nixon White House.
And he had indicated that he had knowledge of this but chose not to participate or something like that. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. Robert?
Well, Paul, you're absolutely right. On his deathbed, E. Howard Hunt told his son, who videotaped it, by the way, that he had been part of the Kennedy assassination and was present in Dealey Plaza. Well, back in 1975, I testified to the Rockefeller Commission for 4 days. And in that period of time, I testified that, in fact, E. Howard Hunt was there, along with possibly Frank Sturgis and other Watergate figures as well. And everybody thought I was crazy. But on his deathbed, he confessed that I was right, that, in fact, he was there, and that he did have a great deal of knowledge about the Kennedy assassination, and unfortunately never went much further than that. But you're right, that did happen. He's not the only person to confess to being part of this, by the way. The mobster, the godfather of Miami, Santos Traficante, on his deathbed said that they had made a mistake and had killed the wrong Kennedy. The original thing they were trying to do is stop Bobby Kennedy from prosecuting mob figures, but they knew that if they killed Bobby, they have the power of the president coming down on them, and they didn't want that, so they killed John instead.
In fact, there's, I guess, some allegation that Howard Hunt might have been one of the three tramps you talked about earlier.
That is correct. We have, through the years, ended up with, I think, four separate sets of absolute confirmed documentation as to the identities of these tramps, and they're all different. One of the most accepted ones is that that one of the tramps was in fact E. Howard Hunt. Well, he may or may not have been. It's not really clear, but there are other pictures of what appears to be Hunt in Dealey Plaza that look even more like him than the tramp. So the fact that he confessed to it is kind of interesting because he had actually filed a lawsuit. Hunt had filed a lawsuit some years ago stating damages because it would upset his kids to think he was one of the Kennedy assassins. But when he appeared in court at another issue, he used his kids as an excuse and an alibi that he was somewhere else. Well, if they knew he was somewhere else, how would they believe he was one of the Kennedy assassins? Made no sense.
I was just reading, though, that the L.A. Times did some examination of the E. Howard Hunt deathbed confession, but the Sun said they have audio tape of it, not videotape.
Well, he actually did both. I've seen the videotape of some of it, but the longer version was an audio tape. I've never met St. John Hunt, but one of these days I'm hoping to. I'd be most curious to find out what the story actually is.
All right. I guess the biggest question then comes down to why, after 50 years, is there still such difficulty believing the official story when there are things like with E. Howard Hunt where somebody at the very end of his life says, you know, I had something to do with it, and then he dies. But it's so hard to keep secrets in government, clearly, over the years. There's been no Bradley Manning, no Edward Snowden type figure would be able to come up with a ream of documents on the JFK case. So why do people, including yourself, still hold so strongly to alternate theories?
Well, the thing is this, and this is something to consider, and most people don't, unfortunately. The official version, that which is called the official version, refers to the Warren Commission story from 1964. But that hasn't been the official view since 1978. Since 1978, the official word from the House Select Committee on Assassinations is that there was, in fact, a conspiracy. That is the newer official version. They back our side. There was at least a second shooter, and we clearly do not know the whole story. But in this audiovisual presentation that I will be presenting at the library, I am going to show a lot of new visual evidence that backs the point. The major thing, more than anything else, if people ask me what's the biggest thing we have, the biggest thing we have is the testimony of the medical doctors. Every single doctor in Dallas, everyone who worked on President Kennedy, said that the shot came from the front. Everyone, without exception. This is something that is very, very important and, to me, is impossible to ignore.
Joyce Halica, to come to the Kennedy information, just more generally, though, less
sure.
about the assassination
okay.
than about the life of
Thank
the
you.
Man. What are some of the things you do have at the Medford? I understand there's even a replica of the Oval Office there.
Oh, no, the replica of the Oval Office is at the airport, and that's where we're going to, when Robert arrives uh-huh. on Wednesday, Bern Case will meet him and take him through the Oval Office. But part of the Kennedy collection is at the airport,
mm-hmm.
at the entry to the Oval Office. Let's see, what else? Mostly what you'll see is iconic. Jackie's pearls, for example. You'll see the official portraits that are in the White House. You'll see them on the as you come into the gallery. It's all glass gallery, just like the lobby of the Kennedy Museum in Boston. It overlooks the Boston Harbor and the water. This overlooks Ashley Furniture and the mall, but most people like this setting. I think what you're going to leave with is a feeling that you have a heart connection with something that you remember. And to me, that's the richest experience that I keep hearing from the people that come. I keep Kleenex there for
right.
that reason,
no
too.
Doubt.
And Camelot music and speeches of Kennedy and documentaries. There's a lot there than just what you see when you walk in and go through the exhibits. About 3,000 square feet with separate rooms and going back to the Kennedy family and all of the children, there are 9 of them, and they're all gone now.
Robert talks about his being impressed with Kennedy mm-hmm. even before the assassination, but mm-hmm. do you think for a lot of Americans there's a greater sense of reverence for JFK because of his life ending so suddenly?
I can say absolutely Yes, that was kind of the final memory that we have of Kennedy, but it was because of the things that Kennedy was involved with in doing, and when he said he was going to do something, we could see shortly the actions that he was taking to make things happen, and yeah, Peace Corps, Man on the Moon, and, as Robert said, the Bay of Pigs, he saved millions of lives. By a phone company. As a matter of fact, there's a phone in there that Bill Meyer did at KMed Radio with John Kennedy telling former General Eisenhower, it's off. And there's a picture of Khrushchev and Kennedy shaking hands above the phone. So there's things to look for that I don't take people through the tour and give them any of my opinions. I let the exhibit speak for itself, and it seems to speak loudly to people's hearts and minds.
You were talking about the things that he was doing at the time of his mm-hmm. death, and do you ever stop to think about how different things might have been if there had been potentially two full terms of JFK? What might have happened to things like the war on poverty, civil rights legislation, the war on Vietnam?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was my generation. It was class of 65 that was sending these guys off to Vietnam. And in history class, I'm saying, wait a minute, how come we didn't study Vietnam if it's so important? Well, we're fighting for democracy. So I kind of left it at that. I grew up and I learned differently. I wanted to quote Bobby Kennedy here, and this is from the Brothers book. He said, I found out something I never knew. I found out that my world was not real. Bobby Kennedy, 1968.
And what was that a reference to?
That's a reference to what he learned later after Kennedy's assassination, I'm sure.
Let us take
and maybe some of the things that Robert's trying to tell us right now.
All right, let's take a call from Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joyce Halica and Robert Groden.
Yeah, thank you very much. I first came to Ashland in 1986, and at a cocktail party, I met a gray-haired gentleman, an elderly gentleman, who claimed to be one of the autopsy doctors. And he said that their conclusion was the bullet came in from the rear, hit the bow tie, and then reversed direction and went back out. I thought that was absolutely absurd. And I don't even remember his name, to tell you the truth. But my bigger question is, you know, what does it do to us as a society to have a right-wing mob assassination before our very eyes and see no repercussions all these years? What does that do to our trust in our government? What would we do if we did find out it was true?
Well, these are good questions. Thanks for that, Brad. Robert, you want to take a whack at that?
Well, yeah. You know, it kind of is a double-edged sword there, too. The Kennedy assassination by itself opened a lot of people's eyes about potential government conspiracies or people taking it on their own to do what they want for their own advancement, whether it be political or monetary. But the thing that made a lot of people aware that the things we were talking about for all these years about the Kennedy assassination were true was Watergate. Watergate opened a lot of people's eyes to the reality that our government officials can and do in fact lie to us, and that was the positive thing about Watergate is it made a lot of people aware and less cynical about the fact that. That people were devoting their lives to trying to find the truth about what really happened to our president. And he was our president. You know, it's been now 50 years, and it may be too late for justice in this case, but it's never too late for the truth.
Let us take another call from Bill in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Groden and Joyce Halica.
Yeah, good morning. The conspiracy theories that have sprung up from the Kennedy assassination, of course, are multifold. It's been become a real industry over the last, 50 years. But I wanted to speak to one particular comment that the nice lady made just a few minutes ago, and that was she was making some implication that Kennedy was against the war in Vietnam. That's totally incorrect. He was one of the main pushers of our intervention in Vietnam. Of course, that was totally a mistake for us to intervene in Vietnam, in my opinion. But Kennedy was dead wrong on that, and I'm just trying to convey some information that runs contrary to this worship of the Kennedy clan.
All right, thank you for that, Bill. Let's talk to Joyce about that.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say that one of the reasons I have felt so strongly about Kennedy all these years was because he had announced that he was going to be pulling out troops from Vietnam a few months before he was assassinated. We have an economy, too, that's based on war, and perhaps his announcement that they were going to be ending the war by bringing home the troops. You have to remember one thing about Kennedy that's a monarch, is he was our peace president. And so the war was going on. He inherited the war in Vietnam, and he was trying to find a way to begin to end that war, if that helps answer where I stand.
But it's one thing to say you want to get troops out, as the current president has, and then another thing to actually get them out.
Well, he didn't have time. This was just 2 months before he was assassinated.
For both of you, Joyce Halica and Robert Groden, once all the people who remember JFK alive have died, do you think his aura will change a bit? Do you think we'll remember him more like Lincoln, who was revered after his assassination, or more like Garfield or McKinley, who were really just sort of like, yeah, they were nice guys, and they got killed in office?
Robert, you have to answer that. I'll have to think about that for a minute.
Well, I'd like to, if I may, just go back for a moment on this and state that President Kennedy was, in fact, ending the war in Vietnam. 1 month and 11 days before he was killed, he created National Security Action Memorandum 263, which called for a full withdrawal from Vietnam. And one must remember, please, that President Kennedy, during his lifetime, had no combat troops in Vietnam. All we had were advisors. Just 4 days after the assassination, Lyndon Johnson created National Security Action Memorandum 273, which called for a wide land-based operation in Vietnam and committed to combat troops. So Joyce is correct. President Kennedy was, in fact, pulling out of Vietnam. And do I believe that President Kennedy will be revered more because he was killed? I think it's unavoidable. But people are realizing now what a fabulous gift we were given by having him as our president. He was so exceptional, and compared to many of the presidents we've had since then, without being political about it, what a difference. What a difference.
All right, Robert J. Groden, thank you so much for joining us. Robert J. Groden at the Medford Public Library at 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock on Wednesday. Joyce Halica, the display at the Medford Center until November 22nd. Open when, though?
Oh, open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 in the morning till 5 in the evening. And on November 22nd, there's going to be a special forum, and hopefully Robert Groden will come back. It's going to be a memoriam for JFK.
Joyce and Robert, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for listening to the Jefferson Exchange today on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. For Reed Newland and Charlotte Duren, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care.